City FM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Crimes of the news of the world, not even touched on by Murdoch family friend Lord Leveson, and their lies killed off Britain's most successful investigative TV show. Well, it's a recurring theme on this show, the demise of television journalism, but one investigative series stood out above the others, led to countless crooks, even international arms dealers, being jailed. 12 years ago, in 2000, Rupert Murdoch's News of the World printed a month-long series of lies about this particular show, and ITV dropped it, refusing to bring it back, even after the Murdoch paper admitted that it had been exactly that, just a pack of lies. Well, the journalist's name was Roger Cook, and his show, The Cook Report, was Britain's most popular current affairs TV series ever, bringing in an audience of around 10 million every week. Well, Roger lives in the West Country, and earlier this week I talked to him about the news of the world and some of the programmes he made before his series was unceremoniously axed. Also, coming up in the next hour, we have an African guest, Sindani Mako, and he's in town this week. He's been fighting to keep his land over in Tanzania. And also, US filmmaker and director of internet hit The Esoteric Agenda. We speak to Ben Stewart. But before all that, our little tour around the world affairs. Martin, we've got a lot of fuss over in China and Japan. There seems to be a sort of bit of a conflict possibly brewing there. I wonder if you could just start by saying whether you think this is saber-rattling, whether there's actually anything to it, whether China and Japan are really sort of sizing up with each other, you know, for a fight.
Potentially, and also with the Philippines over the Spratly Islands. I mean, what we're talking about here is a massive oil and gas reserves in the what the Chinese call the South China Sea. We've got massive gas reserves being discovered in the Eastern Mediterranean, massive oil reserves discovered around the Falkland Islands, and as the economy goes down, we're going to start fighting over scraps, aren't
we? Well, these disputed islands are known as the Diaoyu in China and Senkaku in Japan, so even what you call them is some kind of indication.
Well, it's like the Falklands and the Malvinas, isn't it?
But this is really something about resources, the stuff that's underneath the sea and underneath the ground here.
Yes, I mean, we are basically moving towards a confrontational phase in world geopolitics.
Why?
Partly because the economy is in such a mess. As the economy goes down, everything becomes a zero-sum game, doesn't it? We've got to get that unless they have it, or they've got to get it and to stop us having it. And the US has been trying to push it, chuck its weight around. And don't forget that the Chinese and the Argentinians, in relation to the British, of course, will say, well, actually, this is near to us. What's this got to do with you? Can you imagine if the Chinese were having exercises in the English Channel just outside our exclusion zone or whatever, and saying, well, it's not directed at you, we're just having an exercise here. There's a massive armada of carrier battle groups that's arrived in the Gulf. I mean, basically, everybody is gearing up. I mean, it's quite possible in the next few weeks that all of these things are going to kick off, and one exploding will kick the others off, and then we'll be there, won't we?
I mean, I'm not really necessarily convinced by that. I think there's a lot of stuff which is saber-rattling, a lot of people shouting and screaming, banging the tables, but are they actually going to do
it? The problem with saber-rattling, Tony, is anybody who knows anything about history, is that saber-rattling generally turns into saber-using, and that's the whole point of it. If you don't want to use your saber, you shouldn't rattle it, which is why all these threats against Iran are so unwise, because if you don't carry them out, you look weak, and if you carry them out, you've got World War III, so which is it?
Another interesting story this week, out today, an exclusive in The Independent, censored the MI5 links to murdered Litvinenko. Well, can you just remind us who this guy Litvinenko was?
He's a former FSB, that is to say, what became the KGB became the FSB. He's a former
the Russian Secret Service.
The Russian Secret Service. And he wrote his book called Blowing Up Russia, which is still available in the shops, and in that book he basically makes the claim, which is a fairly credible claim as far as I can see, that the bombings in Moscow in September 1999 and Ryazan killed several hundred ordinary people were actually carried out by the FSB, blamed on the Chechens, in order to get Putin elected in the following election. Sorry, I'm just sneezing there. But, I mean, basically, that is a false flag terror narrative. But when the Russians are doing it, that's perfectly understood that that's quite... Putin's quite capable of doing things like that. You can see the Western press saying, oh, yes, he's terror. Although, interestingly enough, the Western press haven't picked up on Litvinenko's allegations. Because once people get the idea that secret services go around blowing up their own people and blaming it on other people, they might think, hang on, that's not just the Russians, is it? And it isn't just the Russians. Lots of people are doing it.
The story goes on to say the government has ordered potentially vital information about whether murdered former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko had links with the British intelligence services to be withheld from his inquest. Scotland Yard investigated claims that Litvinenko was poisoned with radioactive polonium-210 in 2006, was in regular contact with MI5 or MI6 before his death, as part of an inquiry which led to murder charges against two Russian citizens, both former KGB agents. But a preliminary hearing by the long-delayed inquest into Litvinenko's death, due to start in the new year, heard that Whitehall officials have asked for the findings relating to the intelligence agencies to be removed from the information due to be made public during the hearings.
Yes, it's quite interesting. I mean, there are two major theories in my mind about what's happened here. One is that Litvinenko has been killed by the FSB as a result of his book exposing their false flag terror attacks in Moscow, etc. The other possibility, and this is what the Lugovoy, who's the main guy who's been accused of this, is saying, well, actually, it's Berezovsky and the Western intelligence services who killed Litvinenko in order to blacken us. Now, in actual fact, both theories are plausible.
Another thing that's being alleged here, and this is all this information has come from Litvinenko's wife, who's been privy to all of this, and she's gone to the Independent with this, saying that it looks like he was on a retainer of some kind from the British intelligence services of £2,000 every month.
It wouldn't be an unreasonable thing to imagine that an ex-FSB agent who is now cooperating with the British would be, you know, on the British payroll, and then the Russians might want to kill him. But if the Russians were going to kill him, why would they use polonium, which is so easily traced? I mean, there's lots of ways to kill people without leaving your fingerprints all over the place. And polonium was found at the offices of Berezovsky, who is another character who worked with Putin, possibly on the false flag terror attacks in Moscow in 1999, and then fell out with Putin and ended up over here. The Russians want to extradite him for various fraud crimes, and the British won't extradite him because they claim he's a political exile. But people need to look up Berezovsky. Very interesting character. He used to be best mates with Putin and is now best mates with Dick Cheney. Very interesting character.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, Roger Cook. The Cook Report was Britain's most popular current affairs TV series ever, bringing in an audience around 10 million every week. Roger lives in the West Country, and earlier this week I talked to him about the news of the world and some of the programmes that he made before his series was unceremoniously axed.
I'm Roger Cook. I used to front the Cook Report on ITV and had a very large run-in with the news of the world in about 2000 when they decided, I think probably out of professional jealousy, that they would have me. And they managed to persuade a couple of very junior ex-employees, who seemed to be in it for the money, to invent stories. I mean, one in particular, who was a former specialty cameraman, did undercover work, took £27,000 from them for making up stories, which the film he'd took would disprove anyway, although he was far too fly to give them the film, and they were too interested in getting the story to ask for it. Anyway, after about 2 years and millions of pounds expended, they settled out of court, and after 10 or 12 pages of libel, three of them front pages, during which they accused me of faking everything they'd ever done, they were forced to admit that the Independent Television Commission, which was the regulator then, was right when, after an 18-month investigation, they'd said we'd not broken the regulatory code, we'd done nothing wrong, we hadn't deceived anybody, and we were right. They had to concede about a year on, when the cost was still further escalating, that the ITC was right. And there was an apology, if you can call it that, on page 38, covering 2.5 column inches. And the Press Complaints Commission, for whom I have no time either, thought that was what they called due prominence.
Your programme, The Cook Report, did use some fairly unorthodox methods.
I don't think they're unorthodox at all. We were first to use them. We would use stings, for example, carefully set up stings. The difference between what we did and what tabloids did was that we would only cause people to take part in these stings to demonstrate what it was they did for a living. Known fraudsters, known IRA or UDA fundraisers, for example, they would be encouraged by, obviously, greed or sometimes ego and sometimes both, to present themselves for the camera, thinking they were going to do something else. Now, that's very different from Jack Straw's son at one stage, who thought he was going to get his leg over an attractive Mirror reporter, supplied her with a very small quantity of cannabis, after which he was portrayed as a drug dealer, which he certainly wasn't. So there's a big difference. I mean, we were exposing major criminals. We were exposing, for example, as I said, fundraisers for the UDA, one of whom tried to extort money from me sitting in the back of a car carrying a gun and went down for 10 years after the film was shown in court, and it was the only evidence that was given apart from my own, because people in the province of Northern Ireland were a bit scared, naturally, about coming out and talking about the paramilitaries. So there was a big difference. They'd accused us, the News of the World, at one stage they said we'd faked everything that we'd ever done. How they could possibly prove that in court when we did 130-odd programmes, none of which were faked. They were all very, very carefully lawyered. We had our own code of ethics, which I wrote way back in the days of Checkpoint on BBC Radio 4, which we stuck to. And we had a full-time barrister. No other programmes ever had that. So we were very careful about what we did, very ethical, but they said we weren't. The Independent Television Commission were asked by the News of the World to do an investigation. They made a formal complaint, and when they didn't get the result they wanted, they dismissed it as a whitewash. Eventually they did have to give in. Didn't do me much good, though, because I'd come off the air, as ITV did, unlike the BBC, until I'd proved myself innocent, although they'd said, we don't believe you've done anything wrong, and we'll welcome you back, said the director of programmes, with open arms, when this is all over and the dust has settled. When that had happened, he wasn't there anymore. And the new incumbent thought I was old-fashioned, expensive, and a bit of a dinosaur, really. So I went on to do other things.
Now, ITV runs on audiences and advertising, and you were bringing in something like 10 million per programme audiences for their advertisers. I mean, surely it doesn't make any commercial sense for them to say we don't want the Cook Report back if they've got a 10 million audience coming with that.
You would think that's the case, but I think they didn't like the fact that it was hard work for them. It wasn't just the programme, it was the aftermath. We had to have a sort of after-sales department to make sure that when we were sued, which we often were, we were well covered and could defend it rapidly and robustly, which we did do. We were sued lots of times, never successfully. The programme actually came off the air around 2000.
Around 2000, and that's the time of this four-week News of the World sting. One of the programmes, for example, that you did was eerily prescient in that you were looking at the possibility of hijacking aircraft in the United States in the wake of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And, of course, the year after your programme came off, then we had the September the 11th attacks. Now, I wonder whether you watched those attacks and thought, we're told you so.
No, we did. But then the people we got the information from said I told you so too. We got information from the Philippines that a man called Ramzi Yusuf, who'd been the mastermind of the first World Trade Center attack, was living there and had been chased out of his flat when a bomb went off in the flat. He was making a bomb using some homemade explosive called TAPT. When he fled, he left his computer behind, and on that computer were all the plans to fly planes into the Pentagon and into the World Trade Center and places like that. And also further plans, not only to assassinate the Pope, that got nowhere near getting off the ground, but also to fly planes into each other. And this was the basis of the shoe bomber plan. So it was all there. And the Filipinos, the head of the Manila police, a wonderfully named man called Hermogenes J. Ebdane Jr., gave them all this material, and they dismissed it as the product of a febrile imagination being offered to them by a straw-chewing hick. So we knew what was going to go on, and a number of people in the States also knew, on the fringes of officialdom, who all said, look, this is going to happen. And in the same programme, we, with the help of Dr. Jim Swire, whose daughter Flora was killed in Lockerbie, managed to smuggle onto various planes bombs, fake bombs, but with a substance on board which had the same X-ray signature as Semtex, and we got it through 23 airports. And in one, the worst airport of the lot, the staff went through the scanner with the operative looking the other way with his feet on the desk reading Sports Illustrated, and our cameraman and a researcher got on the plane with no boarding pass and no ticket. That was Boston Logan Airport. Where did the 9/11 bombers leave from?
Now, you're not the only person to have warned about the possibility of a September 11th type attack. For example, the deputy director of the FBI, John O'Neill, he also was warning of some similar attack, and the White House actually blocked his investigation into what he believed were people preparing for such an attack. What is your thoughts in hindsight about 9/11 and the repercussions from it, the war on terror? I mean, is it possible, do you think, that somehow this was allowed to happen because it was expedient?
There were lots of warnings. I mean, there are others. We had a warning from a man from the Federal Aviation Authority called Bogdan Jakovic, who had warned that you could get through almost any airport security, and he'd actually done it. And the authorities blocked all his reports, and when he was still doing these allegedly out-of-the-blue inspections on various airports, he discovered they'd all been told by the authorities. And when he kept pushing, he was demoted and made head of paperclips. The authorities didn't want to know. They really didn't want to know. Expediency, I don't know.
One of the programmes that you did towards the end, Roger, was around the idea of Russian and Soviet soldiers that hadn't been paid for a long time. The problem was that they were actually still on nuclear bases guarding nuclear weapons. So can you tell us about that programme? Because there were some pretty scary revelations, weren't there?
Well, it wasn't just the soldiers. It was the scientists who, before Perestroika, had been up the top of the tree, well paid. Afterwards, they weren't paid at all. So to keep their families alive, you can understand why they did it, although it was appalling, they were stealing nuclear material and selling it into the black market via the Russian mafia, who really are tough. As one of the KGB people, or ex-KGB people we spoke to, said, they make the Sicilian mafia look like Enid Blyton. Anyway, we, with the help of a Russian journalist who ended up having a nervous breakdown and turning into an alcoholic during the process of making this program, we made contact with members of the mafia and went round to this extraordinary run-down maisonette in the back streets of Moscow, where we were offered, first of all, a sample, and it turned out to be weapons-grade plutonium because we had it tested by Minatom, the Russian equivalent of the Atomic Energy Authority. And the guy went grey as he tested this stuff and said it really is the real stuff. We had a very proper English translator who started to blush, and I said, "What's this man saying?" And he said, "You've been handling this stuff, and it's not properly packaged. If I were you, when I went back home, I'd go and have yourself tested, because your balls will probably glow in the dark." Fortunately, they didn't. Anyway, we went to this place and the second time round, and we had organised, and to show you how thorough we are, we actually had, on an overnight purchase, a lot of money, I mean tens of millions of pounds, on deposit in a bank, a crooked bank, in Gibraltar. So when they checked us, as we knew they did, in the little time frame we gave them, the money was there. So we were able to buy what was going to be 6 kilos of weapons-grade plutonium, which we were going to turn into a dirty bomb. You don't have to be clever and make it go fissionable. All you have to do is disperse it. So you stick some gelignite round it, take it to the top of a tall building and blow it up. And we had calculated, with the help of a scientist who used to be in charge of the SALT II talks, that if you did that at the top of a building in Manhattan, bearing in mind the half-life of this material, you wouldn't be able to go into Manhattan for 26,000 years. So it was a pretty frightening prospect. Anyway, when we got back from, very happily, having got all this on film with concealed cameras, to our hotel, we played it back and discovered that a sound lead must have come adrift because we'd made a silent movie. So we had to go back. Now, the first time had been very interesting because they'd kept this stuff, would you believe, took us out into the lobby, and there in a cupboard under the stairs, next to the Hoover, was this fissionable material, which we were going to buy. Anyway, we went back again, and unfortunately, he'd thought we were going back because we were very keen, and we'd represented ourselves as emissaries of a seedy Middle Eastern regime. They were very keen because they thought we were, and we wanted to make a bomb, they said. And he said, "Don't worry, we can save you the trouble. We've got a SAM-20 nuclear missile warhead in the back garden under canvas." And they did. Now, you can't... Now, this is just quintessentially bizarre. But you can't say, I don't like this game, I'm taking my bat and ball and going home, because at that stage they shoot you. So we then used this fact that we wouldn't have the money to buy a ready-made bomb, we'd have to go away again, and scuttled round to the FSB, as I think I said, the KGB as was, and these people were arrested on the day, and as far as I know, they're still road-testing thermal underwear somewhere in the Russian Antarctic.
But there's a really serious edge to this, isn't there, Roger? Because we're being told that the Iranians are trying to sort of start from scratch with uranium, make plutonium in reactors and potentially make a bomb. And what you proved was that because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, you actually proved that these SS-20 warheads, I mean, these are about 10 times the power of a Hiroshima bomb, were available on the black market.
They were, and for, well, lots of money, but comparatively compared to what they would have cost, not very much money. Yes, they were available, and that was pretty frightening. And even if you just got, as we had initially planned to do, just some of the material to make a dirty bomb, and bear in mind, a bomb that would do what I'd suggested to Manhattan was small enough to fit into a briefcase. And the Russians have thought of this themselves. And out of the 70 they made, 23 went missing, and they don't know where they ever went.
In your view, would it have been possible for the Iranian Secret Service at the time to have got hold of one of these?
Oh, come on, if a journalist can do it, certainly a Secret Service man could.
Because one of the interesting things that you always hear from Iran at the moment is we have no intention of manufacturing a bomb. They put it in that particular way.
Well, it might because they've already got one. Who knows?
Another famous programme that you made back in the late 90s was about the National Front. We've now got this kind of new phenomenon, the EDL. What do you think you learnt during that programme that can inform us about how groups like this operate?
Nick Griffin is no fool. He's a Cambridge graduate. And I think he's tried to remove himself one stage beyond, get the foot soldiers to do it, stop banging on about throwing people out, but trying to get people, just convert them to his way of thinking and do it through the system. I don't know that it'll work, but at least when we made his program, he was found guilty of fomenting racial hatred.
The Hillsborough tragedy has been in the news recently again. Now, this is something I think that you worked on as part of the Cook Report, so can you give us your take on what really happened that day and possibly also why it didn't come out at the time?
Well, there was a big cover-up. There was a monster cover-up. We could see it going on. 5 years after the tragedy, we decided to make a programme. ITV didn't really want it. Nobody wanted to do the programme. The whole thing was considered to be a ghastly mess. But we met a lady called Anne Williams, whose son Kevin, who was 15, was one of the victims. And the really strong thing about Kevin's case was that he was alive up until nearly 4 o'clock when he died in the arms of a policewoman called Deborah Martin. Now, the coroner, Dr. Stefan Popper, had decided, for whatever reason, whether he was instructed to do so, I don't know, that the cut-off time for his inquiry should be 3:15, which meant that nothing was investigated after that, not what the faults of the ambulance service had been, or more largely what the police had failed to do. All he was able to do was determine the cause of death, which was usually asphyxia, of people who had clearly died before that time. And then, of course, the preceding Taylor report had determined that the blame for it was failure of police control. We interviewed Dr. Popper exclusively, and he wouldn't have it that it wasn't an accidental death, because he ruled that all the people had died accidentally, which really offended the relatives. Because after 3:15, there were a number of people who were clearly alive. The families thought, even back then, there were probably about 30. We now know, after the independent panel, there were 41 people who might have been saved, which is appalling. We know that, going back to the Taylor report, that the police started it all by opening an exit gate to try and let people into the pens on the Leppings Lane end of the ground. They were already overcrowded, and it was a complete disaster. And within minutes, people were dying, and the match was stopped 5 or 6 minutes in, when people were trying to climb over the fence to stop being suffocated, and the police were trying to turn them back because they thought it was a pitch invasion. I mean, it was utterly, utterly disorganized. We spoke to WPC Deborah Martin, who had cradled Kevin in her arms when he died. She'd said she'd seen a number of other people alive. Other people had. We spoke and traced Tony Edwards, the only ambulance driver allowed onto the pitch. 44 ambulances were summoned, but only one was allowed onto the pitch by the police. He was just swamped, and he said he wished he could have done more, and if there'd been proper preparation, the story would have been very different. We tracked down to a couple of junior policemen who'd been on duty on the Leppings Lane end of the ground at Hillsborough, and who'd said nobody was in command. It was absolute paralysis at the management end of police chain of command. And the man who was in charge, Chief Superintendent David Duckenfield, known to some of his critics as David Duckenweave, we confronted at the time, and he just ducked and weaved. He subsequently was prosecuted privately, having tried to say that it was the fans who'd forced the gate open when he'd actually ordered it himself. He then thought perhaps he'd better not turn up at this private prosecution, which then failed. He then avoided disciplinary action by taking early retirement, claiming to suffer from post-traumatic stress, on a full pension. All this material, which has now come out in the independent panel, we had more or less in chapter and verse 5 years after the event, yet it took another nearly two decades for it to come out, and that is absolutely disgraceful. There was a monster cover-up. People like Deborah Martin, these young policemen we traced, were all heavied. And poor old Deborah Martin was visited by very, very pushy police officers on three occasions who bullied and browbeat her, she says, into changing the original statement we'd made, and lots of people did that. So there was a large-scale, heavy-duty cover-up. It just took forever. I mean, people wanted to believe that the police were decent and the authorities were decent. Well, they were all conspiring, I believe, to make sure that this got swept under the carpet. And I'm very pleased that the independent panel has come to the same conclusion on the same evidence that we presented 18 years ago.
Now, one of the Liverpool MPs was saying, when the independent panel came up with its results, that this could never happen now.
Oh, I believe it could, because the systems are still not in place. Okay, so standing room at grounds is now very different from what it used to be. But, you know, you've got to have decent people in charge. And it is said that at Hillsborough there was a major incident plan, but people were cowering under tables and not implementing it. And it's the quality of the staff. If the training and the staff quality isn't there, then there will be another incident of this kind.
Another program that you did towards the end of the Cook Report was one about satanic abuse. Now, this is people like Private Eye will say this doesn't exist. What did you find out about it?
Well, as far as we could see, it did. I mean, it wasn't as widespread as some people tried to say, but on the other hand, those who said it didn't exist were clearly wrong. We centred on a bizarre shop called The Sorcerer's Apprentice, run by a weird man called Chris Bray, who sold all the appurtenances for conducting satanic ceremonies, but also served as a distribution point for literature advocating satanic abuse and child abuse, and a meeting place for such people. It was in Yorkshire somewhere. The programme went out, and he complained to the Broadcasting Complaints Commission, which was then the regulator, and he was just about the only one who was turned away at the door. You know, he'd made absolutely outrageous complaints, and he was found against. He still went on his website, publicising my address, inviting his supporters to come and punish me as they saw fit, and claiming that he had been found entirely right by the Broadcasting Complaints Commission when he hadn't, and that ITV had had to apologise on the air and publish a full apology in TV Times, none of which was true. And as far as I know, he's still mad enough to be doing that today.
Well, going back to where we started with the news of the world, what are your thoughts about the Leveson inquiry and the expose of phone hacking and some quite serious criminal activity? Just in the news this week is information suggesting that burglaries were ordered from the newsroom.
Oh, I fully believe it. I mean, they were totally out of control. When I was done over by the news of the world, my little local exchange wasn't digital, so there's no footprint to prove it. But my phone, I believe, and so does my lawyer believe, was not just hacked, but tapped. Hacking is just picking up messages from somebody's mobile. Tapping is listening in real time to both sides of a conversation. And we know this because a man calling himself Steve rang up during the course of the legal action we were taking against in the News of the World, saying that he was an ex-News of the World reporter, he was on my side, and he could offer me all kinds of information, we should have a chat. And it became very clear that he was on a fishing expedition, sponsored, I believe, by the News of the World, because he knew some stuff that nobody else did know. For example, he knew that the News of the World's major witness had come to us and completely retracted his testimony. Now, the only people who knew that at that stage were my solicitor and me, because it had only happened the day before and we'd had a phone conversation about it. There's no doubt in my mind that they'd tapped my phone. But as I said, no digital footprint. It's only circumstantial evidence, but in this case, I believe it's good enough for me. And it was a very serious offence, far more serious than hacking, because there were people attempting to pervert the course of an ongoing high-profile libel case. And if they do that sort of thing, they do anything. I've seen people talking, heard people talking about break-ins to get evidence, even break-ins to steal the picture of a deceased person, the victim of a road accident or a mining disaster or something, off the mantelpiece of the bereaved in order to be the only ones with a picture. I mean, no morals whatsoever. So the sort of stuff that came out during Leveson was no surprise at all. The only thing that did surprise me, I suppose, was when Michael Gove MP, himself a journalist, did say that he thought the way the inquiry was being conducted would engender an atmosphere of fear amongst journalists. And then Lord Leveson complained to the Cabinet Office that Michael Gove had exercised the very freedom of speech that was in question by complaining. By saying that, he was undermining the investigation.
What about the results of Leveson? What would you like to see by way of regulation? Is there any way you think that the editors or the industry itself can self-regulate, which is what the PCC was doing?
So. The PCC wasn't self-regulating. The PCC was self-serving. Big difference. I don't believe in statutory regulation. That's the thin end of a wedge, which I would hate to see. But there has to be some form of control, perhaps like on the Irish model, you know, where there's a bit of statutory backup, but it's not in the front line, and that there are real penalties for people who transgress. I mean, at the moment, there aren't.
So, finally, Roger, have you retired?
No. I think if you retire, you're dead. I still do things. In fact, I teach. I'm, would you believe, Emeritus Professor of Broadcast Journalism at Nottingham Trent University. And I still do the odd programme, and I've got another edition of my autobiography coming out in the next few weeks. So, no, I'm not letting the brain die. The body might be, but the brain's all right.
What about your programme archives? Because I think there's quite a lot of people who are looking forward to them coming out on DVD.
Well, two reasons that wouldn't happen. One, they were considered by ITV to be legally dubious, and they didn't want to have people suing them as on DVDs. Well, I think that's a load of rubbish. Anyway, they were all sent to a big storage facility called Iron Mountain in London, which a few years ago burnt down. So there's absolutely nothing left except the odd bit on YouTube and a few memories.
Well, I wonder if you've got a bit of Roger Cook's Cook Report left in your attic on one of those old VHS videos. If you'd like to put it online and you're not able to do it yourself, of course, you can give us a call and we'll try and help you do that. But that was almost the most disappointing part of that, Martin, was hearing that the Iron Mountain people in charge of Roger Cook's DVD archive had just let the whole lot go up in flames.
Yes, but I mean, you're interviewing Roger there now, and that, of course, can be kept and will be kept, hopefully for future generations and for reference.
So why do you think Mr. Murdoch and the News of the World had it in for Roger?
Well, I was asking you that question before you asked me that question. I'm not quite sure. Clearly, he had lots of enemies because he's fighting various power structures, and clearly ITV, at the end of the day, they'd rather be doing something like X Factor, wouldn't they? Or, you know, the kind of whole purpose of having investigative journalism is incredibly problematic for people who are just looking for an easy
but
ride.
But as I pointed out, 10 million viewers, you can't sniff at it. The advertisers will pay for that kind of audience.
Maybe they will, but at the same time, you've also got the legal problems that go with it. As he said, we were sued loads of times, but we managed to get away. You know, we managed to succeed every time because we were very careful about how
they
we
never
went about
things. They were never successfully sued. So no, I mean, you've got to have a robust barrister in there, just making sure that the people who are trying to take you out legally are that you've got a good defence.
How much easier to do reality TV? How much easier?
And how much cheaper?
Indeed.
Anyway, he's taking on organised crime. Quite a lot of what Roger was doing was very high-level organised crime. Probably the highest was what we heard there about him taking on the Russian mafia, selling plutonium and SS-20 warheads.
Yeah, pretty serious stuff. I mean, why don't we have that on mainstream television? Good question.
OK, Martin, thanks very much.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, we've got an African guest now, Speaker Sinande Mako, and he's been in town this week fighting to keep his land over in Tanzania. Hi, Mako, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much.
Can you just tell us a little bit about where you live?
Yeah, my name is Mako Sinande. I come from Tanzania. I'm particularly living in one of the districts called Ngorongoro area in northern Tanzania.
And why are you over here?
Yeah, I just came here 3 days ago. I actually visited one of our partner called Africa Initiative, which actually have been, collaborating in terms of development initiatives.
Okay, so Bristol, I imagine, as a city, is very different from where you live. Can you describe where you live? What's it like there?
Yeah, of course, it's different because, one, there's amazing cars going here and there compared to where I come from, and also we actually enjoyed a lot of natural environment. But when you come here, you face a lot of buildings, cars, traffics. It is a lot of, okay, it is good, but sometimes kind of a shocking for us who actually live in a very natural land.
Now, I understand that the land where you're living is actually under threat. I mean, we would hope that in this day and age that people would not be in that situation where businesses or countries are coming in and trying to take land away from you.
Yeah, of course, there is a lot of problem of land grabbing, which actually facing the pastoral community. I mean, the Maasai were actually the pastoral community living in northern part of Tanzania. Because of the land, natural resources which are found there, there's a lot of pressure from outside to grab the resources and also create a lot of land problem.
When you talk about pastoralism, it sounds almost like some sort of nice life in the countryside. But what's it really like in Tanzania? What is a pastoralist?
Yeah, a pastoralist is a community or society which actually keep livestock, and they are practicing what we call pastoralism. Pastoralism is a livelihood system which actually involves livestock keeping, natural resource management, and also the family, which are actually considered as the pastoral people. And when we say the pastoral society, these are indigenous community which actually depend on land, and also their livelihood is so connected with natural resources that mean water, land, and the forest.
Well, what about ownership of the land, though? Because, I mean, obviously, for many people, for centuries, even in Britain here too, hundreds of years ago, it was assumed that you couldn't actually own land, that everyone needed to share it. So are you in a situation now where you actually own the land that you're living on over in Africa?
Yeah, in fact, the ownership of land is not as individual basis. We actually own land communally, depend on the nature of activities. So when we say the pastoralists own land, it means that there are specific land for grazing, not really for building, like putting the roads, building the infrastructure, like huge houses, like here in Bristol. It's just a specified land which actually serves the life of people. I mean, specified for grazing purposes.
Now, when you talk about land grabbing, what actually happens when someone's grabbing your land?
One is that as you know, that there is international relation, and also there is open of the boundary. There is investment policies that actually the external people are coming to our land, and they want want to invest in terms of having, tourism activities like hunting of wildlife, like building of the hotels. So because of that, project, then they come in, and also the pastoralists are squeezed out of the land to create space for external investors.
Now, obviously, Tanzania has its own sort of government, its own priorities for development. How do the pastoralists fit into that? I mean, do you have a good, you have a voice that's listened to in central government in Tanzania?
As you said, we actually participating in terms of how do we engage, politically in the policy in our country. The challenge is, the livelihood system is not really considered as a livelihood which support the majority. There is a consideration that this is just like kind of a livelihood shift from being hunters and then pastoralists, then you move to farming activities, which is wrong. Pastoralism is a livelihood system which is continue to be and also needed to be supported. So the challenge is people don't understand, even the policymakers, they really don't understand what pastoralism mean. And this is the main challenge that we are actually facing.
Okay, well, tell us about this Ortello Business Corporation, which it's actually threatening, it seems, to actually evict nearly 50,000 people in Tanzania. I mean, who are these people and what are they planning to do?
Yeah, in fact, in 1990s, the Tanzania government provided a land for the an hunting company, which actually in 2009 there was a serious eviction that people were evicted from that land just to allow the company to continue hunting of wildlife, because there's an assumption that there is no possible that human activities and wildlife activities can coexist, which is some something that which is wrong. So the people are evicted to provide a space for hunting company. So this has been a problem that facing the pastoralist.
Well, just reading about this Ortello Business Corporation, it seems it's actually owned by people in the Middle East.
Yeah, of course, this is a United Arabs company.
Which United Arab Emirates.
Emirates, yeah. which actually came in to Tanzania just for the purpose of conducting, tourism activities.
Okay, and it's just tourism, literally. What happened in the original evictions then, when they first started moving in? Just give us a description of what these evictions are like.
Yeah, the eviction is, the government sent field force to the area, and the people were evicted, and the bombers, their settlement were burned, and the people were removed from the area. So this, which led to a serious death of livestock, and which actually led to a lot of poverty within the society.
And what are you doing to fight back against it? And what can you do?
Yeah, in fact, people went back to their former land after the community movement and the campaign that was done, and also they decided to go back. And currently now, people went back to their former land.
Okay, now what about tourism? Ultimately, surely there has to be some facilities for the tourists. What's wrong about what's going on in your land?
In terms of tourism, as I said before, that people don't believe that tourism activities can be contacted in the area where the local people are. So they create a lot of separation between livestock and wildlife, and also in terms of separation, they remove the families from those areas. For instance, we have one company which actually from United States which actually give a land by one of the Tanzania company as a leasing, and then from there people were evicted to graze in that particular area, and then in the course of going, the local people opened the court case to sue the company in order to get back their land.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts about this one? Because it's a United Arab Emirates company that's doing this, and it just seems that it's almost like nothing has changed in the last 200 years. People are still being treated like dirt in places like Africa.
Well, I'm just listening to what I'm hearing. Obviously, the idea that you run local people off, then you have tourism, and then presumably you get foreign exchange from the tourism, which you're supposed to get some benefit from this in the long run. But of course, for the people who are there, they're not going to get any benefit from that, are they? Presumably the money is being made by people in Dar es Salaam or whatever. It's not going to local people at all. And there's no cooperation with local people and what they need.
Yeah, and this really has been a problem, because what we expected that, okay, we needed to share the income from the natural resources, because yeah, we actually consider the balancing of livelihood. The pastoralists need money to promote their livelihood, and also their resources are within the land. So we need to see or to acquire the right to use the income from the wildlife.
See, the thing that fascinates me is, to a large extent, what you're going through now is what people in this country went through maybe 300, 200, 300 years ago, 400 years ago, as they're being evicted from their collectively owned land. Now, I wonder, is it partly because it's more difficult to own land as a community than it is as one person? If you're one person or a company, then actually that land is easier to sort of administer or whatever, rather than having a sort of a whole village really trying to own the same piece of land.
You know, sometimes the people have different livelihood systems. Other people want to own land individual or a family. But in the context of the pastoral people, that could not be possible, because you want, a free land for grazing, to allow different grazing season. And also in relation to climate change effect, that actually we get a minimum rain. So if you are just fixed in one area, you can't access another area, automatically you lose your livestock. So we need a wide range land to allow our livestock mobility. Otherwise, if you cannot move from one area to access several resources like water and fresh grass, then we can't survive.
Well, it sounds to me like fences are going up. How can people help from this part of the world? I mean, what can we do?
One important is just to have an international campaign, just to promote the livelihood, because we actually have our partner here, like African Initiatives, which are actually linking in terms of looking for resources, because there is a lot of work to be done on the ground, like training people to be able to engage on policy formulation, which actually required a lot of resources. And this can be done, I mean, internationally, to ensure that our partners are getting resources to support the local people in the ground.
Well, that's lovely. Thank you. And just to let you know, the website for African Initiatives online is www.africaninitiatives.org.uk. So
you and they're follow, based in Bristol.
Yeah, they are. And you can follow the sorts of talks that Mako is doing this week on there. And we'll be doing that in future weeks. Well, Mako, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Okay, thank you very much.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, now I'm joined by Ben Stewart. Ben is a US filmmaker who's touring around Britain at the moment, and he made a film called Esoteric Agenda. Ben, hi, and welcome to Drive Time.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Now, Ben, can you just give us an idea what you decided, why you decided to make this film? Why this specific film? What was the mission?
The mission was actually non-existent until the film was actually made. The film actually kind of just stumbled into being. I'm in a band. I have been for the past 10 years. I was in the military for 6 years. So coming up towards the end of my enlistment, I began realizing the greater, mission that I was a part of and what I was lending my energy to in the military. And so that began impregnating the lyrics of the band and the message of the band. So in order to make that, or how the film came about is, people were asking me, what's the message of the band? I decided I was going to make a 15-minute film about the message of the band, including like some music and stuff like that. And then a couple months later, it turned into a 2-hour film that has nothing to do with the band, and I wasn't even planning on releasing it, really.
But you were, the idea really, one of the ideas anyway in the film, is exploring consciousness, which is a big, big topic as a platform for social change. Mm-hmm. What's that all about?
Well, see, the thing is a lot that went into the film Esoteric Agenda had to do with pointing out specific things that are going on in the world. However, that's not really to the core of what my work is. It's It's recognizing how we are the transformers of the energy that then creates the form of our society, of our culture, of our government, and all those things. Everything outside of us is a reflection of what's going on within us. And this can be seen in simple cymatics when a vibration gives...
Hang on. What's a cymatic?
Cymatics is the play of sound and matter. So there's an experiment where on an iron plate you place lycopodium or sand, and then you pump a frequency into it. And when you pump a certain specific frequency into it, a geometric pattern emerges. And then when you raise the frequency, it almost like an amoeba, it changes form and turns into more complex
patterns.
Yeah,
I seem to remember that at school, actually. Anyway, look, before we talk any more about the film, let's have a little listen to an extract from it. And this is from Ben's film, Esoteric Agenda.
In Nesta Webster's book, The World Revolution, she states, "The art of illuminism lay in enlisting dupes as well as adepts, and by encouraging dreams of honest visionaries or the schemes of fanatics, by flattering the vanity of ambitious egotists, by working on unbalanced brains, or by playing such passions as greed and power to make men of totally divergent aims serve the secret purpose of the sect. People with money were welcomed but kept oblivious to actual secrets. The purpose is to win power and riches, to undermine secular or religious government, and obtain the masters of the world. The goal of the order was and still is to one day deliver the human race from all religion. Progression through the political and religious hierarchy was obtained by blackmail in the form of bribing people in power with sex from local prostitutes. In the 16th and 17th century, high-ranking officials in political or religious organizations were liable to be sentenced to death for such acts. In 1780, Baron Franz Friedrich Knigge was recruited. He was the most instrumental person in the marriage of the Masons and the Illuminati. This allowed the Illuminati to expand rapidly with the use of Masonic lodges. On August 29th, 1781, Congress of Wilhelmsbad declared the alliance official. Those in attendance were put under oath, never to reveal what took place in that meeting."
That's a little extract there. And that was the Wilhelmsbad conference you're talking about there, Ben, where this is the original Illuminati, which certainly did exist at the end of the 1700s, which there's lots of evidence for, was supposed to sort of take over the whole of European Freemasonry at that conference. But have you got any evidence that this Illuminati organization still exists today?
Well, see, the way that my work is actually led from there has less to do with even the bloodlines that are involved in the Illuminati, and more to do with what it is within us that allows for this idea of the Illuminati. So, to answer your question, not really. Since 2008, when I put this film together, since that, no research has really gone into the specifics of the Illuminati all the way up till now.
Because this is one of those bugbears. And you talk a lot about the New World Order. What do you mean by the New World Order? We hear this term bandied about, and I think almost everybody that uses it has got a slightly different meaning.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Because it's what the New World Order means to each and every one of those individuals. Now, an order, if you look at what order actually means, is an organization of, whether it be cells or an organization of compounds, to create something that has a specific function. Now, we know that a tree is a specific order of minerals and obviously different things that has a specific function. It takes in from the earth, and then like a factory, it refines those things, and then there's a fruit. Let's say an orange tree creates then a fruit. So that thing has a specific function or an order. So when we're talking about the New World Order, specifically in this film, obviously it had a little bit of a negative connotation, but the overarching thing about the New World Order is moving from what the function is of our species and where we're heading as a whole collective organism, as a species, and where we're kind of heading. So
okay,
there
so
will
where
be
are,
a new
where,
order.
Where are we heading? And where would you like to see us be heading?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to say where I would like to see us heading, because that's really just mapping out mental territory, which I think a lot of people have a hard time being able to latch onto a specific mission statement.
Well, where are we heading then, if you don't know where we should be heading?
Well, what's happening is... the boundaries of the current paradigm, the mental paradigm that we're living in, because remember, all of my work gets into the fact that what we're experiencing now is an inner expression playing itself out in the world. So what's happening is the boundaries of our paradigm are breaking down, just as in cymatics, the form begins breaking down when going between one frequency and another.
This is where I would like to bring Martin in. Martin is also talking about this thing quite a lot, about paradigms breaking down. Do you think it's possible that that with all the sort of financial problems going on, the problems in the Middle East, particularly the threatened war, that something that actually might be a good catalyst and humanity might actually get something from it?
Well, it's a time of great challenge, is it not? I mean, there's clearly some very negative things happening as we speak, and the possibility, the only hope we have, is that out of that negativity will come an awakening of consciousness and a willingness to have a better world. But it's to be honest with you, I'm not really very spiritually minded, and I see everything that's negative at the moment, and I'm afraid the only thing that keeps me going is the old adage that you've got to have pessimism of the intelligence and optimism of the will. You've got to keep on fighting, even if you're going to lose.
Well, I mean, you're also in the military, Ben. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's everyone's right to hold their own perception. However, all of my work gets into the way that we perceive the energy that we have, whether it's pessimistic or optimistic. That's the way we perceive our world is the way that we transform that energy, meaning the way we perceive the world is how we are going to, in a sense, translate that perception to other people around us, because we do influence other people just by the very way we live. So just remembering that there's no right or wrong way to look at the world. There's just the way that we look at the world, and there's the way that we don't look at the world.
That sounds a little bit postmodern for me. I mean, I like to think that we are actually able, on this show, for example, to actually tease out some truth from what we hear. But anyway, what's your next film? What's your project right now?
Well, the project that I'm working on right now is The Hanged Man Project, which is basically using art as a platform for social change, because art inspires change.
Okay, well, that's the serious talk out of the way, because for the last time, we've got a new show after the show next week, Friday night. It's Music Night with 2 hours live with Spike, Rodsey and Pat Hart, inviting you to join them at the Fresh Blood Party. Next week, we look at empty offices and housing with the webmaster of SpeakTruthToPower.net and one of the founders of the Community Land Trust movement. That's Tony Crofts from Bristol. Also, the government seems to have given up. What's the church doing about social inequality and redressing the widening gap between rich and poor? You'll find me, Tony Gosling, and this show at thisweek.org.uk. And don't let the banksters get you down.